Flowers for Elephants, how a conservation movement in Kenya offers lessons for us all. When northern Kenyans find elephant bones, they lay down blossoms and branches as a mark of respect, honouring their crucial connection with the wildlife they live alongside. In a changing world, these values are vitally important. Peter Martel tells the exciting story of a conservation movement that gives us hope. From tracking elephants through the bush to gun battles with bandits and treks through Al-Qaeda cut territory. The book is called Flowers for Elephants. It's by Peter Martel. Delighted to be joining me live on the line. Peter himself. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on.
Pleasure is all mine. Just explain a little bit about where in Africa we are then. Northern Kenya. So draw me, if you like, you know, an idiot's guide to where in the continent we are.
Kenya is East Africa, the right-hand side. If you imagine a map of Africa, there's a sort of pointy bit that almost hits, goes towards Yemen and Saudi Arabia. If you go down a bit from there, that's Kenya on the Indian Ocean coast. And northern Kenya, well, as it sounds, is the top half of the country. It's about the northern half of Kenya. It's about the size of Germany. And it's a vast area. And it goes from, it includes Mount Kenya, which has got, you know, glaciers and snow on the top. So not what you might imagine if you've got a picture of an arid, dry image of Africa. So snowy peaks. But that goes all the way up to what is, you know, baking hot deserts. So it's this extraordinary landscape. A lot of open wild bush and savanna grasslands, and that's full of wild animals, with elephants and giraffes and lions and rhinos. In these days, it's under threat from many different reasons, but the animals, the wild animals, have been struggling.
So what's attracted you to Kenya? How did you end up then in northern Kenya?
Well, I'm a British journalist, and I've been working as a foreign correspondent in across Africa for a decade and a half. And I ended up working in Kenya for the French news agency, AFP. And I was based in Nairobi in the south, which is a big, modern, bustling city, you know, millions of people, high-rise concrete tower blocks. But we get these stories across our desks of, you know, what would come to us as tribal cattle raids in the north and from the north of Kenya, in which you get dozens of people killed, essentially battles over water and not ownership of land as such, but to the rights to graze, for cattle to graze on the land. And I was driven to sort of trying to find out a little bit more. And, you know, I would go up to northern Kenya. It's this extraordinary land full of different peoples. There's, you know, more than two dozen different ethnic groups, all speaking their own languages. One of the most and biggest is called a Samburu. You might, if you can picture a Maasai warrior with, you know, these incredible colorful clothes and beads and red painted hair, and sometimes on their face as well. These are sort of types of groups that live in this land.
It's not only sort of tribal, isn't it? Because there has been the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, and we tend to think of Mali, perhaps of Nigeria, but it has affected Kenya as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of Kenya's neighbours is Somalia, and there's a group there called Al Shabaab that's an Islamist fundamentalist group, and that's sort of allied to Al Qaeda. And these groups spill over into northern Kenya because these borders are, you know, there's no demarcation on the ground. It's just a line on the map. And, you know, terrorist groups can operate in areas where there isn't, you know, good security and government control. And often these areas are really far from, you know, from police posts, from army posts, or if they are, it's, you know, it's a man, it's one policeman and his little outpost. So the areas where parts of these areas where terrorist groups can operate in these sort of remote areas.
And not only do we have these remote areas having, you know, harboring terrorists, but there's the wildlife. And I mean, the book is about elephants, but I suppose this the first time we really looked at the situation was with the rhino. And we all know the struggles that we've had to preserve these majestic beasts, but the rhino was, if you like, perhaps a turning point for realizing what was going on up there.
Absolutely. I mean, what was happening in northern Kenya is that the wildlife was being decimated as people were fighting over land and water and grazing. And as you said, these areas, this conflict was also being exploited by, you know, in some areas by Islamist fundamentalists, these groups allied to Al-Qaeda. And, you know, the wildlife seemed like it was sort of not the most important thing to care about. I mean, people were obviously, rightly, more worried about looking after their security of their children, their family, of making sure they could earn a living. But what the story of the book is about is how a conservation movement came together to realize that if you didn't start protecting the animals, the wild animals, they would be wiped out entirely. And what has happened is this conservation movement has essentially brought together formerly warring communities, so different ethnic groups, different tribes that were fighting over cattle and land, and said, look, you know, the land and the animals that are on it is our common resource. And if we continue to fight, they're not going to have anything left. And so in a strange way, this push to try and protect these dramatic, majestic beasts like rhinos and then elephants brought the communities together and found common ground between them. And through that, they've ended up, you know, building security. And with security, in terms of, you know, stopping fighting, in terms of better security, has come the ability to, you know, build schools and create small businesses and create jobs and employments and new roads and clinics and medicine and water wells. And with that, the level of violence has decreased and people have been able to improve their lives. So in a strange way, you know, the efforts to protect the wild animals has had an incredible beneficial impact on the people that live there.
And in a way, because we are so used to seeing stories of Africa, you know, this brilliant continent, you know, the wonderful, diverse wildlife, incredible people through the whole continent. And yet there's always that "this is Africa" feel to it in terms of, oh, blimey, it's corrupt. We've got poachers. There are intertribal war. And whenever news seems to come out of Africa, it always tends to be last ditch. It always tends to be depressing. It always tends to be, you know, it's being destroying. So this book, if you like, is, you know, and in a time in which we find ourselves today, Monday, the 7th of March, it does point that, you know, people can look at the big picture, and rather than people saying, oh, well, these guys have got nothing, and so they want to hunt rhino, they want to kill elephants, you know, they are part of a disenfranchised and uneducated peoples who have turned to extremism to try and solve their problems. This is perhaps not the normal story that we get out of Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've lived there for many years and I've covered a lot of conflicts, you know, and I've seen, if you want, some of the worst aspects of what war really can do. And as a foreign correspondent, sadly, you know, I feel sometimes responsible. You know, the news that I would write often was the very worst. It did give this sense of not much hope for Africa, this giant continent of 55 plus countries. And so this was a story that when I started to research, I was like, for years we are writing about northern Kenya is essentially a place one step away from a civil war. You know, there were battles over cattle raids, but it would involve dozens dead with people shooting themselves with AK-47 rifles. And yet over the decade that I was in Kenya, these really started to decline. And sadly, as a journalist, what you do cover often is the bad things, the negative things, the horrible deaths, the massacres. And it's a lot harder to tell a story of change for the better. And that's something that I wanted to say in this book and say, look, you know, it's not hopeless. Things can really change. And here's this remarkable story of people who came together across different linguistic groups, languages, different tribes, different peoples, vast areas. As I said, this is an area the size of roughly about the size of Germany, and came together and said, look, you know, we're not benefiting any of ourselves by creating this violence. How can we stop it? How can we reduce it? And how can we protect the natural resources that we share? And most obvious of that with these animals like elephants and rhinos and giraffes that are so symbolic and so beautiful, and that people traditionally have this incredible relationship with. You know, this is what the Flowers for Elephants title comes from, of how people realize that they are dependent on these wild animals for how they shape the landscape, how they move with their cattle, that there's a symbiotic relationship with the wildlife that they live alongside. So yeah, it was an opportunity for me to try and tell a different story that wasn't of a hopeless Africa that, you know, there's no future for, because it's completely the opposite.
So many times in these stories, when it seems it's impossible to get people to sit down, to discuss, to plan, it always tends to there seems to be a fulcrum, there seems to be a starting point. It can be one person, it can be one situation, one location, or one group. Is it, in your case, it's a cattle ranch that is the catalyst, if you like?
Absolutely, yeah. This was a huge cattle farm on quite, you know, beautiful golden grasslands now, but there's cyclical droughts. And this was a colonial era, you know, cattle ranch that was inherited from Britain, when Britain had Kenya as a colony. And it wasn't really very successful. The farmer there, you know, of white British origin, but born and bred in Kenya, was struggling every year, would hit with drought. Cows would die, and he would try to increase the cattle ranch. And it was basically a failure. But he sort of took a wider picture and said, you know, why? And he realized, well, you know, it's not designed to be so intensely farmed. And he, all around him, he saw these rhinos being massacred, being killed, to the point where if there was an effective level of extinction of rhino in Kenya, if they hadn't taken action. It had gone from around 20,000 rhinos in, say, the 1950s, to around 200. So, you know, there were barely any left. And the ones that were left were isolated. So effectively, you know, they weren't going to breed. They weren't enough together in one area to create a stable population. So this farmer, he did this extraordinary adventure story of flying around, finding where these remote rhinos were, and would dart them to put them to sleep, and then put them on trucks and bring them back to the cattle ranch. And over the years, what became a rhino sanctuary in the heart of this cattle ranch became this extraordinary sort of rewilding movement in which the animals came back with the rhinos. They started to breed successfully. Other animals started to come back. Elephants came back of their own accord because they found, with the security that the rhinos on the farm were getting, they said, oh, look, here's a safe space to be. So they returned. And then the giraffe came back. And now this what had been a cattle ranch, a place called Lewa, just north of Mount Kenya, it's now part of a UNESCO, so United Nations Cultural Organization. It's one of their World Heritage Sites. So on the sort of scale of the Great Pyramid of Egypt or Stonehenge in England, and in terms of natural sites, like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, for example. So what had been a dusty, failing cattle ranch, it's now, you know, an extraordinary return to the vitality of nature, and a real message of hope of, like, actually, this is a place that most people would have written off as a bankrupt failure 50 years ago, and today is a flourishing place with more rhinos now on this small what had been a cattle farm than there were in the entire country 30 years ago, and now the rhinos from this place are being sent out. There's too many for the area they've got. They're being taken back out to repopulate areas where effectively they were exterminated entirely from. So, yeah, an incredible success story.
And also, it shows that, you know, people from whatever their ideological backgrounds, and I use those words advisedly, can put their differences aside for a greater good, which you would think, because we pigeonhole people. We, you know, especially in the media, we tend to black and white things. And there are, as we know, several shades in between that. And so it just shows that, you know, if, you know, people who have opposing views about where they should be going in terms of religion, ideology, whatever, can actually get it and get the bigger picture.
Absolutely. You know, this conservation movement now has knit together about sort of two dozen different tribes, different peoples, across communities. If you pitch them all together, it's a patchwork of lands. But if you stuck them all together in one area, it's about the size of Switzerland. So a vast area. And people who have been traditionally enemies for decades, and exacerbated by a sort of flood of automatic weapons, of AK-47s that came from other conflicts in the region and flooded this area. And people took a stand. They saw where it was going. I mean, they could look to neighboring Somalia or to the north, to neighboring South Sudan, both countries really struggling with bitter civil wars, and said, no, this is not the route that we want to be taking, and step back from the abyss, if you want, and said, actually, what we do have is this shared resource of land that many times they've been fighting over. They said, well, look, how can we share it for the benefit of both sides? And they created, on a very simpler level, what you might call just community councils of elders and young people and women and men all coming together saying, let's decide how best to manage our land to protect the resources, the water, the grass and the wild animals on it, and share it with our neighboring communities, potentially previous arch enemies and rivals. But now let's learn how to live together, and realizing that, coming together is a much better way of living than always fighting.
I mean, a good news story out of Africa is always welcome. And one of your previous books is called First Raise a Flag, which just talks about South Sudan and how it won the war but lost the peace. And to have a good news story coming out is a great thing. And also, you must have been relatively pleased to get a forward by His Royal Highness the Duke of Cambridge.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, the Duke of Cambridge has visited these areas and spent time there. I think he spent time on his gap year in between school and university and has visited again. So he has seen for himself, the change in these lands and what can be done when people come together rather than fight. So he was very keen to, help promote the book because it helps promote what these people have done. And as you said, give a good news story, which I think is something we all need in this day and age of when you look at the terrifying warnings of climate change, and when you look at the conflicts around the world, it is all too often too easy to put your hands up and say, well, what's the point? Everything's going to be doom as apocalypse. And here is a lesson from people that have really lived on the edge, really struggling in some of the most difficult arid areas, right where climate change is really felt. When you live off the land you live upon, whether it's your herd of cattle or your herd of goats, climate change is felt daily. And these are people that said, actually we can, climate and violence and conflict doesn't have to divide us. It can actually be a reason to come together, to work together, to try and solve it. And that, I suppose, is the key takeaway for all of us, that there is hope, but we've got to make a big effort, but it's not all doom and gloom.
The book is called Flowers for Elephants, How a Conservation Movement in Kenya Offers Lessons for Us All. It's by Peter Martel, who we've been speaking to today. Peter, if people want to find out more information about you or about the book, I know you have a website.
Yes, it's petermartel.com, and you'll be able to find more information about the book and me, if you care, on that site there.
Only begs the question, Peter. I mean, what are you up to next, and what's because I mean, covering Africa for covering Africa as your beat, quite a few stories out there. What are you up to next?
I at the moment, I'm actually speaking to you from Cyprus, and okay. I'm working covering North Africa and the Middle East, and sadly, the conflict in Ukraine and the ramifications on other parts of the world is what's sucking up our time. But if I had a choice, to try and find more stories like this of not just doom and gloom, but where there is change that can be made in the world. And to try and tell those stories and amplify them, so to help inspire people and show that things can change, and here are people that have done them. Basically, here are people that have shown us the way already.
A good news story for a Monday morning. Oh, it's been a while since we had one of those. The book is called Flowers for Elephants, How a Conservation Movement in Kenya Offers Lessons for Us All. It's by Peter Martel. It's available as a download as well from our virtual bookstore. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.